Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now is my good friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners. Every Sunday night, Byron puts together a very thoughtful note on what to expect for the week ahead. And he joins us now to discuss a little bit of what to expect in the week ahead. Byron, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
Especially because you joined us on Friday as well for our regular Washington Roundtable. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our strategy coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Byron, talk to us about what's on your mind and what you're looking forward to over the coming week. We've got a lot of hearings going on. There's a lot of geopolitical action. And obviously, last time I checked, an American presidential race. Take it away on what is on your radar screen.
Well, yeah, I think obviously the big event, the marquee event this week is going to be the first of three presidential debates on September 29th. The topics that were set forth for that debate, however, really nothing's going to be there for defense or national security. But more broadly, just kind of what's the state of the polls, who's deemed the winner or loser of the debate. And then I'm sure there's still going to be more additional stories on the New York Times revelations of President Trump's tax return. So that's going to be kind of an ongoing backdrop, obviously not just this week, but right up to and probably through the election. But then kind of thinking about the more prosaic comments, I won't go over the continuing resolution saga because I think that was covered very well in the Friday broadcast. But there are three hearings that are kind of relevant to defense national security this coming week.
So what are the hearings that you're going to be most focused on?
Well, the big one is going to be Senate Armed Services Committee has a hearing on October 1st with the Department of Defense Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment, Ellen Ward, on supply chain integrity. Now, I'm sure that's going to touch on some of the issues we talked about last week, on the question about the use of PPE funds, what did the DOD actually buy? But, and something as broad and sprawling of this, kind of the what's the health of the defense industrial base, where there's still pressure points or what concerns might be in the supply chain if we start to see a pickup in COVID-19 cases over the balance this year. And then there are always the other issues about microelectronics, rare earth elements. I mean, just part and parcel. But I think it'll be an interesting venue for Ms. Lord to kind of talk about these issues and also to kind of hear what's on the mind of the committee itself. The other committee, Well, the other interesting committee hearing will be House Armed Services on September 30th on U.S. defense posture changes in the European theater. That really goes back to the withdrawals that were announced by the Trump administration, kind of moving troops around, forces around from Europe back to the United States, other parts of Europe. So, again, I don't think these are going to be, earth-shattering news-making events, but kind of an update on two issues that are relevant to contractors.
Talk to us a little bit about the COMDEF conference. That's a great event. I should say I've been affiliated with it for a very long time. I'm going to be moderating one of the discussions about the future of defense spending that will have Britain's defense minister in the United States, Ed Ferguson, but also Fred Bartels of the Heritage Foundation, Mackenzie Eaglin, one of the regulars on our panel from American Enterprise Institute, and Andrew Hunter from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But what are some of the messages you're going to be listening to? The event will be taking place tomorrow and on Wednesday.
Yeah, and that's another event, Fago. I've traditionally attended that event when it was held live, not virtual. I think it usually happened that week right after Labor Day, but like a lot of things, it's been pushed out because of COVID-19. It's always been a good gathering. It's really kind of an in-the-weeds assessment of U.S. defense export and international defense cooperation. So Again, Ms. Lord's going to be speaking at that event as well. I'll be looking, I guess, really just kind of what's the color, what's the state of play here? You know, there has been a lot done to try and improve U.S. export competitiveness, you know, but at the same time, you know, ITAR restrictions, sanctions, all the other things that can sometimes get in the way of that. So I want to hear all sides, you know, what kind of what's really the state of play on this. And it's historically been a good conference to kind of catch up on these issues. And Vago, just to conclude, there are two other things that I'm going to be keeping an eye on. There is a September 30th event that IISS is holding in London on Russia's military modernization. It's kind of they're launching a dossier and a deeper dive on this. And then the other thing on Thursday, October 1st in the afternoon, CSIS is doing a discussion on the defense services industrial base, which I think a lot of people overlook. You know, they always think about hardware and metal. But, you know, this is kind of an overlooked subject, and I'm glad they're kind of shining a light on it. I think David Berteau of Professional Services Council and Eric Tuning, who had been with DOD, is now back in McKinsey, are going to be talking during that event.
Speaking of international trends, right, I mean, this administration, on the one hand, has been talking about the importance of allies and partners. On the other hand, the president of the United States has been somewhat rough with America's allies, Germany in particular. Britain was hoping in this period of Brexit for a very quick trade deal. That hasn't transpired either. And at the same time, we're seeing an extraordinary survey by the Pew Organization that indicates how the United States is seen around the world. Why don't you talk to us about these sort of different elements, right? I mean, on the one hand, how's this administration doing track record, right? Right, because from a rhetorical standpoint, it's really, really good. But regarding, and also operationally, right? I mean, there's a lot of cooperation. At the same time, there is this discordant note that people around the world are taking. Talk to us about the yin and yang of international cooperation and where we stand right now.
Yeah, and the Pew Research poll, I guess, was done this past summer, you know, really talked about, I forget, it was 15 countries, I think, that were citizens were polled. And, you know, the takeaway was perceptions of the U.S. have plummeted. Now, how does that, you know, I think there's already, there's an ongoing underlying degree of cooperation with close allies, but I think a lot of them are going to be looking at the outcome of the November election. And it's almost too soon to tell, but if the U.S. continues with, I think, what a lot of people perceive as a very transactional approach to relations with allies, you know, asking them to pay more money, or, you know, South Korea, same thing. I feel that, well, two things that are going to happen. You know, first, there may be more hedging. You know, can they really rely on the United States when the balloon goes up in a crisis? And I suppose the second part is, look, for countries that are going to increase their own defense spending, you know, why should it be any different if the U.S. increases defense spending? There's an expectation it's going to be spent in the United States. So I think you see the same pattern emerge in other countries. The Tempest program in the UK is probably a great example of that, where, you know, they're not going to do an F-35 again. So I think it's going to take time. I mean, the one little event that occurred yesterday was, yesterday being Sunday, September 27th, is the Swiss very narrowly pass a referendum to proceed with a new fighter replacement program. And, you know, currently the Swiss operate F-5s and F-18s, FA-18s. Those aircraft are going to be replaced in a program right now where the competition is the F-35, the F-18, Rafale, and Eurofighter. So it's going to be intriguing to see, you know, will the Swiss again continue with a U.S. relationship? We saw Belgium pick the F-35. You know, some of the more recent competitions, Poland certainly went with the U.S. supply for F-35. But I just think it's a trend we have to watch and be considerate of and see where it goes. And I don't have a particular view in, you know, what the Swiss may do. But, you know, when you see these shifts in popular reactions, I think it's fair to assume that those reactions probably are also going to be reflected in the views and biases of the governments.
There's this sense, we talked about it a little bit on the podcast, as you mentioned, and there's this sense that Switzerland, which is in a very, very different place, right? I mean, it's still a very neutral country. And at the end of the day, almost all NATO allies, as well as America's allies around the world, want a stealthy attack jet, whereas the Swiss requirement is much more for a defensive fighter. And so there's this sense that the F-35 might not be tuned to the kind of requirement that the Swiss are shooting for in terms of it being, again, kind of that air defense interceptor jet that historically they've acquired to try to protect their airspace, as opposed to it being a sophisticated strike airplane, because obviously Swiss troops don't really participate in international missions very broadly. Let me bring this around to the presidential race, right? In your note, you have a very interesting reference, right? And you noted the election that could break America. And for, you know, depending on where you sit on the political spectrum, it's either it is the election that's going to break America, or it's the race that's going to preserve America, right? I mean, so it depends on how you look at it. Are you surprised that at this point there isn't a bigger defense discussion, or do you think that the conversation does expand?
No, what I think, what's fascinating to me is, you know, there's been a discussion in Washington, D.C. on this. As a matter of fact, you know, last week, the Senate Homeland Government Affairs Committee held a hearing on domestic terrorism, or I shouldn't say domestic terrorism, but homeland security threats and domestic terrorism came up in that. New America, the future security forum that they held, they spent an afternoon talking about this issue. There's a CSIS event this week, I think on October 2nd, that's going to deal with, that event is on September 30th, that's on domestic terrorism and the U.S. presidential election. So it's not really an issue for defense directly. I mean, we're not going to be buying, you know, this isn't the equivalent of the global war on terror. You're not going to be doing drone strikes or buying, you know, MRAP vehicles or, you know, a national air intelligence network to kind of track the movements and the activities of these various groups. But, you know, and I don't know, you know, I suppose there really are scenarios where everything comes out okay in November and December. But, you know, it is on the minds of people in Washington, D.C. It's being talked about in Congress and in the think tank world, and the media picks up on it. I don't see it as a positive per se for defense because it could take resources away and put them more into domestic security. It could compel a greater call for the resources to address some of the very core underlying problems that may give rise to radical behavior. And it's just something I really put this out as a series of questions because I do think they're questions that people ought to be asking right now. I don't think they ought to be acting on them, but let's just see what happens in October and then November, December, and maybe we'll get some clear answers to those questions. But I would not be thinking that this is something that's going to be a sentiment or a fundamental benefit to major U.S. defense contractors.
Let me ask one last follow-up question. Mark Zandi today of Moody Analytics, the chief economist there, was talking about how his expectation was that a Biden administration is going to be better for American economic growth. We obviously don't have any idea how the election is going to turn out. Donald Trump pulled it out of a hat last time. It's certainly possible that he will do so again. And it's also a possibility that Republicans actually make significant gains, right? And don't lose the Senate and the White House, as is an expectation at this point by some pundits. But if you listen to what Joe Biden is saying, in some respects, he's as nationalistically American in terms of creating domestic jobs, in terms of reshoring industries and making sure that money goes to U.S. suppliers. I was talking to a Trump administration friend of mine that said, a former Trump administration friend of mine who said, in some respects, Donald Trump is going to make life easier for Joe Biden, and that European allies will, will be drawn closer and will sort of understand like, oh, wow, that's another alternate reality. We should really be thankful for what we have. Let's keep spending, it makes life easier for Joe Biden. And on China, there's an expectation that Joe Biden is going to be as tough as this administration is, but somewhat more organized. Mark made that point today on CNBC. How do you calibrate these needles, right, on what, even if there has not been as specific or as widespread discussion, what are the messages you're picking up from the team about where a team Biden would be on these issues?
Well, I think, the number one factor would be, sure, you're right. The disagreements we have with China, the use of sanctions, it may not be as aggressive. I think the most important thing, it's not going to be unilateral. And so, this is a constant theme that the Biden people have talked about, is you've got to get back to a more cohesive effort with your allies to address some of these issues. And I think that's going to be a distinguishing factor. I can't comment on, would Biden be better or for worse in the economy? I personally don't think that the market is really discounted. If Biden does win, what's the impact of higher corporate tax rates, for example, if that's going to be realized in 2022 and beyond. And I suppose the other obvious gating factor is going to be, who really, what's the margin of control in the Senate? And, if Biden's elected and the Republicans somehow managed to keep a one-person majority in this thing, We're back to the last 2 years of the Obama administration, and not much is going to get done here. And I don't think that's a recipe for, we just aren't going to get to some of the problems that need to be addressed in how our healthcare system works, and in what we need to spend on infrastructure, and what we need to do in education, all these other things. So, I like everybody. I don't think anybody has a really good crystal ball as to how this is all going to play out. And I keep thinking of it more in terms of scenarios and then adjusting the probability scenarios.
And very quickly, we've got Belarus that's in turmoil. Russia has indicated that it will come and become involved there in the event that Alexander Lukashenko wants help from Moscow in order to stay in power. Moscow repeatedly, and the Putin administration has made clear that sort of revolutions don't sit well with it. And that was causus belli, obviously, in Kiev. But we also saw that happen in Georgia, and then Russian meddling elsewhere to try to keep democracy from having its way. We saw that even in Moldova and in Montenegro to a degree. And you also have the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan precipitated hostilities some weeks ago. Turkey has said it will firmly back Azerbaijan, effectively egging Aliyev on. Very heavy fighting now in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. And Vladimir Putin is involved because it's the security guarantor of Armenia, setting up a potential clash between a NATO country and Russia. How are all of these changing the security environment, and do they become issues in this race or not?
I think the simple answer is no, unless something really big and bad happens. And I mean, you get the equivalent of a Tiananmen Square in Minsk. I think, however, though, what's really fascinating and at the same time daunting is how interconnected so many of these different things appear. And I'll just start kind of randomly. One of the things I think that's going to be interesting this week, I guess President Macron of France is going to be in Lithuania, Latvia. I don't know if he's going to be in Estonia, but he is going to apparently meet with the Belarusian opposition leader I probably won't say her name correctly, but I believe it's Tikhanovskaya. And so that's going to be kind of an interesting, you know, what's going to come out of that meeting? You've got, as you mentioned, you know, what now looks like a war, not just little random sniping or artillery exchanges, but something a little bit more serious in Armenia and Azerbaijan that's not just limited to the territory that's disputed between the two countries. And the Turks apparently are taking a stronger and wider role in this in support of the Azerbaijan. So, and then you kind of roll this back between Turkey and Greece in the Eastern Mediterranean territorial dispute, where France is kind of out and kind of back Greece. And then the Turkish intervention really kind of changing things on the ground in Libya. So it is almost kaleidoscopic in nature. I think it does point to a period where, you know, we're going to see a lot more geopolitical instability. You've got the COVID-19 overlay on this as well, too. And I was reading something this morning. This was just a kind of an appreciation of local perceptions in this conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And, you know, one of the theories was, well, why was Azerbaijan acting now? And one view was that, well, it's because the U.S. is so tied up in its own domestic election issues and Supreme Court justice, all this stuff. I mean, they're not going to have the bandwidth to really kind of forcefully intervene and put it, not intervene militarily, but really get involved in this and kind of separate the two conflicting parties. So I think we're in for a very tumultuous time period here, Vago. And I don't necessarily see that is all good for U.S. defense contractors. It may turn out that it's good for European or Asian contractors.
As we saw for French industry, right? I mean, yeah. France came to Greece's help and was, you know, it's hard to say that's why Paris did it. But then Athens rewarded France for its support against a Turkish drilling vessel, right? A French frigate got involved, as well as Rafale fighters. And now there's an order of Rafales that's gone to Dassault.
Right. And Turkey, you know, the drones that the armed drones that they've been using both in Libya and now it appears with the Azeris, you know, have been pretty effective. And so it's fascinating because as much as there's this perception of the world's a more dangerous place, what works for the U.S. defense contractors is there's kind of engagement on U.S. policy and a strong perception that the U.S. is going to be there when these things start to bubble over and fester. And right now, I think we're on the cusp of change in that sentiment. And I watch that and, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But
30 seconds, Mike Pompeo surprised Iraq by saying that unless Iraq did a better job of cracking down on Shia Iranian-backed militias, we heard Mark Esper make a call for Iran to behave more as a normal nation. But Mike Pompeo threatened the United States will just withdraw from Baghdad and from the embassy. How does that affect? I mean, that kind of came a little bit out of the blue.
Yeah, but it gets back to, so what's the U.S. role going to be in these places? And if your threat is to withdraw, you know, and you've got a country that really is a basket case because of conflict that existed prior to COVID-19, but now has been slammed by COVID-19. You've got Iranian regime that's probably, you know, under stress and duress as well, and yet Iraq has been kind of a big strategic prize for them. So I just don't see this kind of rhetoric as supportive of something that would give a lot of allies a warm and comfortable feeling.
Well, and again, right, I mean, if you're German, you're seeing that kind of a withdrawal happening even within the confines of NATO. Byron, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. Look forward to having you back on again on the Friday roundtable.
You got it, Vago. See you then.
Thank you. And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.